Oh man, first person shooters really suck, and JRPGs are like the best type of game.
You think so? I don't.
No, not really, actually. But that was how it was portrayed in the last podcast.
Oh, you heard that, huh?
Yeah, I heard that. And I'd like to, for those keeping score, Vink was wrong about the pronunciation of Tengen.
Oh, yeah. So it is Tengen for sure.
Yeah, it is. Not for sure, but like Nolan Bushnell, is that how to pronounce his name? Oh, Lord, I'm going to be wrong again. But like Atari is formed off a Japanese word meaning like basically it's like a checkmate in Go,
right.
The game of Go.
Right.
And Tengen is also a Go term.
Yes.
So if he's using the same pronunciation from that game, then it is Tengen. But you know, it's old habits are hard to break because I always called it Tengen, and so did my friends when they existed. You know, back in the day.
Do they no longer exist?
No, they haven't existed since 1994.
Your friends haven't existed since 1994?
No, the company. My friends haven't existed since 1992.
Oh. Just like Ninja Gaiden, I guess.
Yeah.
Old habits die hard.
Yeah. Oh, man. Old habits do die hard. I don't know. There's so many words that you never actually heard spoken. You just read it.
Right.
And you know, Jen is like probably how we would pronounce things. What other one was I getting wrong for a long time? Tecmo's easy. Maybe it was Konami.
How did you say Konami wrong?
I think it was Konami or something, or no. I don't remember. I fixed that one early on.
Yeah, not on this show.
I actually heard that one spoken on a show or something.
Right.
So it's
not pronounced the X-bone?
Well, that's how I'm going to continue to pronounce it. No, I'm not that guy. I'm not the guy who spells Microsoft as $, but...
Oh, no.
But if there was ever a reason to...
Right. Who gets those dollars anyway?
You know... At first, I've been just going through the stages right there. I went through denial, definitely. I'm like, oh, no, they're going to come up with some way to still do the used games. And then, like, I was really angry. I was angry. I think I took that out on some message boards. You'll find angry Vink posts scattered around. But now, I guess I don't know. It's maybe not one of the stages of grief. I guess acceptance isn't quite there, and I'm just really depressed.
Wow.
I just like feel like the industry that I love is kind of slipping away.
Well, you don't even have an Xbox 360. Like, this doesn't really affect you.
What do you mean this doesn't affect me?
Well, as far as we know, Sony is only rumored to possibly be following the same path, but we don't know for sure.
By the way, by the time this podcast comes out, we might know for sure, but...
Why is that?
Well, E3, right?
E3 is in 2 weeks.
Oh. Okay. Well, we're going to know pretty soon.
I should say E3 is next week.
Thing is, and I could be very wrong on this, like I was on the pronunciation of Tengen, but I have this feeling that... Sony's gonna go the same way. I mean, I don't want them to. I hope they don't. And maybe they were planning to originally, but maybe they'll change their mind now with the terrible reactions that have been coming out. But I don't see how Microsoft's plan works if Sony's not on board. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing. Like, if this is just a Microsoft-only thing, they've pretty much possibly... made this their last console generation, unless they go back on it somehow. If Sony's there too, then that does change things, and it makes you wonder if it's enough for people to play Nintendo exclusively. Probably not.
And that's the thing that's brought sadness. I realize that I'm in the minority, not the majority now.
Are you?
I think most gamers don't care. Okay, listening to you guys talking on the podcast, I mean, the overall consensus was, other than you, who is still on the fence, they're both going to buy. And they're about as hardcore people as we get, right? I mean, you know.
You're, of course, referring to Zach Shipley and Justin Severson / Severson. Yeah, see, that's another one of those things. He won't even tell us how to pronounce it, that jerk. they both said they were going to buy the system, regardless.
Them said, we need to abandon the past.
I should probably clarify my position. I mean, you know, this show lives in the past, right? Like, we started this podcast like fearing that retro gaming would become something that's also of the past and not just something you can bring with you to the future. And this is like the ultimate, like final nail in the coffin. You know, this is it. Like if it goes this way, then in 20, 30 years, we won't be talking like this.
Sure we will.
Or like people who were our age then in the 80s won't be talking like this. So, yeah, I feel like if they make an Xbox One essentially like the next iPhone for consoles, then it might not matter. Maybe.
Now, I'd like you to clarify your position on why it might not matter. And for those who are not exactly sure about all of this, please listen to the previous podcast. It really sheds a lot of light on what these people's positions are. Wow, these people. Wow, these I can't follow. Rage. but basically, Sean, can you succinctly summarize the point you made last podcast?
I can try.
Okay.
So what I think Microsoft is gunning for having games potentially up to the developers, of course, depending on web services of some kind or, you know, online cloud services. Processing, storage, that kind of thing, and then virtualizing their hardware, they're going to make it really easy for the hardware to kind of not matter. Make it very, very easy to switch from one Xbox to the next, and it'll be an iterative thing more along the lines of an iPhone. Not as frequently, mind you, but like, you know, there's an iPhone 5 and a 5S, but they're all iPhones, and they all run essentially the same way. If you have like an Xbox One, Xbox One S, whatever, you know, I don't know if they're going to go with that kind of crazy branding, but every few years release a console, a bit beefier specs, but then it runs all your same stuff as the previous one did. The hardware disposable. Yeah. Then it's kind of the same thing. Cause you know, there have been many, many iPhones and stuff that ran, well, for the most part, I would think, stuff that ran on the first iPhone will run on the newest one as well. I think the only problems people really have are with things, newer stuff, not running on older hardware.
Yeah.
That's a little bit unprecedented in the hardware software space, honestly.
No, I see what you're saying there, and for the most part, I think it's possible that could be their plan. But like that involves the customers taking a tremendous leap of faith, because I mean, for example, the stuff, I know it's a different architecture, but the stuff that they've bought on the Xbox 360 won't transfer over to the Xbox One already.
Right, that's just because of the architecture change.
I agree, but they're. We have to assume through this that there's never going to be another architecture change.
I think that's a pretty safe assumption at this point, because it seems like consoles and PCs have been on this collision course for a long time, and the architecture change is sort of like, again, to not overuse this metaphor, the last nail in the coffin. Like, consoles being their own thing, it seems pretty clear this generation, this is the last time we're going to think of them differently, I suppose.
I guess.
But unless Nintendo holds on, like the big lumbering elephant they are.
But is PC-based architecture the future?
Is PC-based architecture going away?
Yes.
Why do you say that?
I think we're going mobile.
Interesting. Tell me more.
I think that already sales of ARM based processors are over the sales of x86 based processors. True. And I don't see that trend changing.
But those machines can't do what PCs or consoles can do.
Yet.
Yeah.
Look at the difference between the first smartphones and the smartphones we have today. That's a change of only 5 years. Or 6 years. That's, you know, one console generation.
I like to think of this as like an and versus an or thing. Like, I think a lot of people like want consumer devices, and they're going to go, they're going to tack towards the ARM processor model because that's just what they want to do with their stuff. They don't care if they can render high end graphics, and people who really want those high end PC gaming boxes still buy and make them. Definitely.
Yeah.
So I don't think that PCs are going to go away, but I think they are going to lose their seats like the dominant device out there. Definitely.
Yeah, I think it's going to become a more niche product.
Right.
Oh, sorry.
So, I would think the console space is one of the few places where that architecture can even live on.
Interesting. That is, if consoles live on.
Right. what if all of our gaming's finally in the cloud, and then we just have our Microsoft Surfaces and Ouyas and whatever other like dumb terminal.
Yeah.
That's
possible. The on live and things like that. On live? On live?
Oh man. We should just call this episode mispronunciation. Well, I mean, you know, we were talking about this earlier since Microsoft's basically said that we gotta wait until E3 to hear the whole story, that's what we're gonna do, I guess. Just talk about what we expect at E3.
But
next week.
That's the thing. Like, by not giving us the whole story, all that's left is rampant speculation. So, I mean, Microsoft is telling us, don't overreact, you know, calm down, wait till E3. But really, the problem is their fault.
I would say so. I've been watching a lot of video and such about this. We had Justin on, not only because he's a Powat TV guy, but because he's been undownloaded a few times. And in fact, just hosted this week's episode. But it was the last one that they talked about the Xbox One with Adam Sessler and Jim Lauterbach, where they, you know, really sort of brought that whole idea to the fore that Microsoft's messaging is definitely to blame, especially when someone lost their job, like over the messaging.
Adam Orth. Okay.
I should actually credit a different Revision 3 show, in which I totally forget, but it was like just some random gaming roundtable. But it's like Revision 3 games. So I could probably link that in the show notes. But they're one that brought that up. It's like, you know, they knew what we wanted to hear at this press conference. They knew, you know, because a guy lost his job over it. They knew, but they would not tell us.
No, it was only in comments after that. And the thing is, the comments after that were different depending on who you asked.
Yeah, they were not on their game at all. Like, they were contradictory, potentially. They didn't tell the whole story. Like,
it
you
was
know,
like they it was like they were shocked that people would ask them.
Right. Even though they had all this lead up. I don't understand. I feel like, you know, Microsoft is hardly an old company, and like, you know, they were one of the first technology companies ever. And they do things a certain way, and they're like, I feel like, scrambling to find a new niche because the whole paying lots of money for a software model isn't going to cut it for them anymore.
Yeah.
But I just look at this, and it's like they do things so much like a 20th century company still. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, it's so strange. Like, I mean, there were comments afterwards that said, oh, no, there will be – the used games are going to be blocked. And then someone else said, no, used games are fine. There's a future for used games. And then another one is like, used games are there, but they're going to cost the same – but the licensing is going to cost the same as a new game. And then, no, used games will be there, but it's going to be a smaller fee that's paid out by companies like GameStop. Is Microsoft Xbox always on? No. You can use it. You can use it offline. It depends on the mode. No. Never mind. It has to check to see if you're on every 24 hours. And then other people saying no. It requires an always on connection. These are real people working for Microsoft, and they're all giving different answers. It's like they don't actually know.
I mean, that could be, but I feel like it's more of a thing like they don't want us to know what the truth is because they're just finding a good way to spin it right now. Can I give you an example?
Go ahead.
So I think I may have mentioned on the show earlier, or I definitely mentioned it on my appearance on the No Topic Required podcast. That's Zach's show. Yeah, I take it back. I didn't mention it here. I should probably mention it here. So I bought Injustice for the Wii U.
You mentioned this here.
Did I? Okay.
Yeah.
So it's since come out that like the DLC, which doesn't exist yet, will be out this summer, or at least they're going to make an announcement for this summer. I'm not sure which.
No announcement at all.
Right. Yeah. So for a while they wouldn't tell us anything at all. So even, people to speculate wildly that it's just not coming, even though it says in the back of the box it has DLC.
Yeah.
So they and WB Games did nothing to discredit this notion until they finally said, "Oh, we'll have an announcement this summer," which is in itself weird. And then there was just recently last week the official Injustice game Twitter account was asking people stuff like, "Oh, what's your favorite Harley Quinn skin?" And I pithily replied that it's none because I have the Wii U version. And I got a response saying that, "Oh, you know, well, we have an announcement this summer about DLC, so please stay tuned." And that's all they would say. And I was like, "Oh, well, are we going to have things like any of the retail exclusive skins or the stuff from the iOS game that isn't compatible with the Wii U?" And then all that they said back was, "You know, just stay tuned for that announcement." Which doesn't mean they're going to tell us. It just means that they have nothing to tell us until that announcement.
And the announcement might be like, "Wii U gamers, screw you."
Right. It's like, why is this even happening? I mean, I have theories. Well, that's all we have are theories. But I think the most plausible one is that there's just so many resources to go around. The PS3 and the Xbox 360 have alone, either one of them, bigger install bases than the Wii U. And together, you know, far surpasses it. So they spent all of their time like working hooks in for the iOS app into those two versions of the game, getting those skins ready for those versions of the game. I think it's a miracle that all three of them even came out at the same time, like the actual discs were released in stores at the same time, given the way things are going. But they felt like we at least get the disc out so that we don't get any questions that way. But the DLC, I'm wondering if they even were intending on releasing the DLC.
Well, like, I mean, when it comes down to it, Nintendo gamers traditionally were not as connected, you know, and DLC on Nintendo platforms, when it existed at all, usually did fairly badly, you know, but the Nintendo gamer traditionally is more of a family unit, and a lot of the systems are not hooked up, but with the Wii U, it's so much more of an online system than any previous Nintendo console that I think... and the people who actually have bought it at this high price right now are definitely the more technically savvy people than the average, like, Wii Fit customer. So,
right.
I don't know.
I should along those lines, I wanted to briefly mention, too, that they did announce in Japan there's going to be a white deluxe, or I guess they call it premium, model, but they're going to keep the basic white model on the shelves.
Good job, Nintendo. So way to not confuse the customers.
I'm hoping they're going to eventually retire the basic model entirely, and you just have to pick what color you're going to buy. Assuming anyone buys Wii U's at all, boy, that's going to give them the shot in the arm they need, right?
Oh, Nintendo! I'm not a business guy. I know that. I realize that. And I know Nintendo's been successful for a long time, but some of these decisions they've been making lately, I'm just like, really, Nintendo? Really?
I just brought that up because of what you said, but I just think about this Injustice thing.
Yeah.
And
I'll tell you. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm going to buy a Wii U.
Yes.
Definitely. And now it's going to be pretty much, I think, well, this the ball's in your court, Sony, but if you go with the same draconian DRM policy as Microsoft, Wii U is going to be the only system I buy this generation.
Holy crow. All right.
Period. I mean, and if Nintendo, and you know what, if they both go with this and it's successful, which it probably will be, or it doesn't even have to be successful, it just has to be profitable. Like, the gaming landscape could shrink But if they're making more money per user, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Like, take the Xbox. They're basically saying, first world countries, yes. Anybody else, too bad.
Can anybody but a first world country even afford these consoles?
I mean, you're basically eliminating, like, a lot. Not everyone. But, I mean, as our Famicom Dojo viewership and listenership has shown, that a lot of our listeners come from outside of you know, Europe, the United States, Canada, and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, even Japan, like, all of these things with the TV and stuff, or even Europe, all the stuff that the Xbox One's announced with the TV, those are partnerships set up with American companies right now.
Well, that's not any different than Nintendo TV, is it?
No, Nintendo TV is very localized. They have a robust service in Japan, you know.
Well, what's to stop Microsoft from doing the same thing in those countries?
I think it's that Nintendo TV is not quite as linked to cable operators.
Yeah, I guess sure, because that seems like to be its driving feature. Like, I couldn't even really use it until they finally added Netflix support or Hulu support.
That's not a cable operator.
No, that's what I'm saying. I don't have cable anymore, so it was useless to me.
Yeah,
like they could tell me like the on air stuff, and it's really cool. Like you can point the gamepad at the TV and it would change the channel for you. But like I can't watch TV live anymore. I just don't have the time.
Well, yeah, exactly. But the thing is, from the reveal, at least, it looked like Xbox was very much hoping that you'd use it in conjunction with live television.
True. Yeah. They had all those apps like the fantasy football stuff that would like overlay on the TV, which I guess that's okay.
And I mean, a lot of the stuff that it was showing was like, it made it look like the Xbox One was like a DVR as well. It's not. You have to hook a DVR up to it.
Right.
You know, it's not the all-in-one entertainment hub that it kind of looked like from the reveal.
But you know? To give Microsoft credit though, they made this feature front and center, and it's probably going to be live day one on like Nintendo TV, which took months to go live, or at least weeks.
Well, I'm sure. I'm sure it'll be day one. I guess I just don't care. I mean, I don't. This is not something I want or need as me. But again, I realize I'm in the minority here.
So like, you know, I think we came in this week thinking we'd talk about E3 and what we're excited to see, especially because, you know, Microsoft's saving the second half of their presentation until then. But now talking about this, I'm just wondering, like, does that matter? Like, does E3 even matter anymore?
No. I don't think so. I mean, it matters for building up hype for people like us. And, I mean, the thing that's going to... Let's go back to our messaging topic a little bit. Microsoft is going to say that their E3 presentation is not going to focus on any of the TV or any... It's not going to focus on any of that crap. It's just going to be game, and that's exactly what they should do. And with all the hype for those games and their exclusives and their reveals, the other stuff that people are concerned about, the DRM stuff, the always on stuff, the no used game stuff, is going to fade into the back.
How can that not be the focus of their presentation though? Because everyone's wondering about it. If they go another press event without mentioning this, heads are gonna roll.
Oh, no one's like, we the enthusiast gamers are thinking about it, but if you probably ask ten people on the street, like, how was Microsoft's presentation afterwards, they're gonna be like, oh, Call of Duty, Madden, they're gonna be on this, they look really nice. They don't care. We care. They don't care. Majority of gamers don't care. And that's what depresses me a little bit.
I don't know if they don't care so much as they're not informed. And they're not going to be informed by Microsoft, that's for sure, because if they knew what was going down, they would not be happy either.
Well, I don't know. Look at the podcast you just had. You guys know exactly what's going on, but all of you pretty much decided that you will or probably will get this box.
That doesn't mean I'm gonna.
So you see, if the people who are most concerned, the people who are most in the know, still will buy it, the games are there, then Microsoft has nothing to fear. They don't need to talk about this at all. They don't need to talk about this until after the box is released. They can keep, skirting around the issue until the thing is released, because by then it's too late.
Well, I don't know. Like, I guess I'm kind of hoping against hope that something between now and whenever the natural life cycle of the console would end, assuming it even has one, that something would change. Especially when it becomes clear as the generation wears on that there's something really, really wrong with the way that things are being. Like, it's only going to take a couple of weeks or a year for people to realize that their discs are worthless. I've heard really great arguments for used games being a price control on what new games cost, and it's going to take Microsoft and their publishing partners deliberate effort on their part to facilitate that service for gamers, or they're just going to see a huge drop in sales.
I think they can still see a huge drop in sales and retain the same amount of profit. That's the thing. This model is very, very much in their favor. It's very much in favor of the publishers. It's just not very in favor of the consumers. For the publisher end, they don't need to sell as many units as they sold of the Xbox 360 to still make a profit.
How do you? That doesn't make any sense to me. If you like sell 100,000 units, say, of a game last generation, and like Halo 5 only sells 60,000 at the same price. But it costs more to make. How are they making more money?
Okay, because there's no other fees other than what Microsoft, especially for a product like this. Like right now, there's the cost of making a disc. There's the wholesale cost. There's the cut that the store gets. There's all that stuff. With this, it would be in like what Microsoft is really trying to do. And then this maybe the tinfoil hat on, but like. This whole still printing discs is just a stopgap. They want everything to go 100% digital.
Oh no, we mentioned that last episode. Yeah, like the fact that they have discs at all is just another means of digital distribution. It's inconvenient, but they're gonna make you install to your hard drive and then you're done.
Until broadband catches up, but They're probably hoping more than anything else that people don't go to GameStop and buy the disc.
I'm not even like talking like where they're getting it from. If they're like buying it online, like a Nintendo eShop or something like that. But they only sell if they sell fewer units, physical, digital, whatever, for a game than they did last generation. That they can't make more money at it. They just can't. The math doesn't work out.
If they sell significantly less, I suppose. But if they sell
even one less, because their margins aren't getting any bigger, I can tell you that much.
I suppose. I think. Well, okay. If game development costs continue going up as high as they are, definitely. The other thing is though, like if they sell a bit less, but they have less cost in bringing the game out, one can make more. You used the metaphor last time about the Macintosh and Windows PCs. Like, Apple makes more money than almost any computer manufacturer in the world, and
any company in the world.
Yeah, the iPhone makes more money than any other smartphone manufacturer, despite selling less. Samsung sells more phones than Apple, but Apple's making way, way, way more money. It's yep. That.
Right, but their actual models doing business aren't changing. They're just cutting off an entire secondary market instead, hoping that money is going to go to them. I don't think they realize that secondary market is subsidizing their market. It's not cannibalizing it.
Either.
Because they don't price their games correctly, and now they're not going to have any pressure to price them differently. they're going to learn a hard lesson, I think.
What I'm really worried about is no matter, like, no matter which outcome happens, we as the gamers are kind of screwed. Okay, Microsoft model works. Let's say it works.
Okay.
Thing goes DRM completely, and we give up our resale rights, and you know, a lot of you know, and the ability to play games down in the future and things like that. But the video game industry still makes enough money to keep going, keep making games. Okay, other one. This model doesn't work, and it results in a video game crash.
Right.
Way we as the gamers are kind of screwed.
The market only crashes if Sony jumps on board and everyone ignores Nintendo. Like, both those things have to happen, and I don't believe that both of those things can happen in a sane marketplace.
Already have. But the reason that I think Sony might not go that way or go in a slightly different direction, maybe leave it up to the publishers, is because the secondhand market is a bigger thing in Japan than it is in America.
Okay, right.
And games are more expensive in Japan because of that secondhand market existing. Final Fantasy XIII that came out was $100. But
right.
If you sold it back, you'd get $80.
Right, so it's like a $20 game, right? That's how the secondhand market acts as a price control on new games.
The thing is, when in America, GameStop, you buy a game for $60, you sell it back to GameStop for $20, you know, and they sell it for $55. Now, that's not really a fair pricing model.
Right,
you know?
Right. But still, the point is you're paying less than full price for a used game as long as you keep that habit up.
Yeah. So, here's the thing. Wow, I say that a lot. That's my message. My message is, here's the thing. But what I feel really bad for is if Sony does adopt this model and Microsoft adopts this model, the retro scene as we know it is going to change dramatically. Basically, well, right. What it means is the retro scene is probably going to go from collector to collector, eBay, things like that, but dedicated stores selling retro games will not be able to survive.
Unless they're selling, you know, the current, you know, 80s, 90s retro games are selling now.
Well, exactly, but eventually old stock will be depleted and older games eventually break. You know, there can definitely be a niche market for, but like companies like the big companies who sell used games, they're not going to be able to make a go of it because right now most of their money comes from reselling things like DS, 3DS, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3 games. I mean, they make some money selling the retro stuff, the 8-bit stuff, the Dreamcast stuff, but most of it comes from one, two generations ago. And if you cut off that, like this was the last generation you could buy used games for, the majority of the money comes from more recent console generations. It'll last 10, 5 years more, but after that, it just won't be profitable for retro used game stores to exist anymore.
I feel like I should point out at this point that if anyone's listening thinking like we expect these console makers and publishers to make their games and their consoles, keeping in mind that like this stuff should be playable hundreds of years from now, supporting a market that they don't have any say in, that's not what I'm saying at all. I don't think it's what you're saying either. It's just, you know, a sort of fact of the hardware of the 80s. You know, you had cartridges, which are pretty durable. You had hardware that was more or less solid state. You know, there weren't any moving parts. And then that sort of changed with the disc-based systems. That move scared me because the longevity of those systems seemed less certain. But we've seen, you know, there's like a digital versions of those, a lot of those games now. Or in the case of the PlayStation, there's streaming versions. So there's an outlet, at least, you know, temporarily, to play that stuff. And who knows, maybe at some point when we have these uber-duber computers that can emulate anything in the world, this will be all a silly joke and we'll just be like sharing ROMs forever and ever. Like, you know, people do. Like, I think that's part of our problem, too, is that, like, you know, we actually care about buying and participate in the secondary market when there's lots of people who just emulate anyway.
And that's the thing. That's what I realize is that the majority of people, they don't go to used video game stores with the intent of buying 8 and 16-bit games. You know, if people are, you know, they want the newest, shiniest thing, and that is the majority of gamers. Retro gamers are listening to our podcast right now. Hi, guys. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. But the majority of people who play video games don't listen to, you know, they're not on podcasts, and they're definitely not on retro podcasts. They might want to go and download from Virtual Console or similar services, and Sonic the Hedgehog game if they're older, things like that. But in general, they don't care if they own a cartridge or if it's complete inbox. You know, it's a very niche market, and it makes me sad. But I don't know if that type of market can be supported if the decisions companies are making go this way. But at the same time, I can't really blame companies for going this way.
So if you hear us kind of like twisting ourselves in knots, or you hear other similar podcasts or shows having similar reactions, it's all because we're just speculating wildly, right? Like we don't know what they're actually planning, what they're actually going to do to support a secondary market or corner it or whatever it is they're going to end up doing, because it just won't tell us. And I feel like my comments last episode were more about sort of like jumping ahead of like the potential good side of this, instead of just being like this old curmudgeon who's like, well, you know, not doing it the way they've been doing it for the last 30 years in this used game market, so I'm just gonna, you know, raise the white flag and give up and be like, oh, used gaming is dead forever. There are avenues forward. They're just not what we're used to. It's a huge paradigm shift.
I think so too, and that really is. But I mean, when you compared the Xbox One to the iOS, I mean, I can kind of see where they're going there. And if that is the way that they go, where pretty much everything that's been uploaded stays online forever,
right?
And that once you buy something, you have cloud access to it for the entirety of your life, and the prices are low on older things. I maybe can, you know, sort of get behind that. But it's the same way with any iOS app. When they release something that costs more than $5, I have to think to myself if that's what I want to do.
All right, I recently finished and put up that Why Can't Metroid Crawl video, finally. And I made this comment kind of in passing, but it's really, really true. You know, the fact that this is even happening was because it was being played on Virtual Console and being shared via Miiverse, because it was on Virtual Console and could be shared in this very public, concentrated form. And, you know, if people were really buying, like, the SNES cart and playing it in the Super Nintendo, this wouldn't be an issue, right? But
the type who would buy the cart will know why Metroid can't crawl.
But, yeah, exactly. But this is the future, right? Like, there's Steam. There are DOS games I can't play anymore, because I don't even have a PC that has DOS, I don't think. You know, I might have installation disks, or, like, you know, a 3.5-inch floppy that I don't have any drives that can read it, you know, but it's out there and it's usable. But, like, things like Steam come along, they license the properties from the original creators, and then they sell it to us at bargain basement prices. It's way cheaper, even if it's $8 or $10 or whatever it costs to get Virtual Console stuff. It's way cheaper than having to procure the console for yourself and then having to buy the individual carts and having them take up space in your house. So, yeah, DRM is bad, but, like, from a cost-effective standpoint, you just get it for whatever platforms are available for you, and then in 10 years time, 20 years time, if you can't get your games that way, someone's going to come with the Steam 2 or whatever, and maybe it's going to be just the games that are really popular, mind you, because I doubt you're going to see The Immortal on Virtual Console ever, because of, for whatever reason,
Nintendo.
But you know, it's like, for the most part, there's going to be ways going forward. So I'm kind of trying to think of this with that in mind too, that Microsoft's going to have some kind of solution just because it's going to be profitable for them.
If it's profitable for them, they'll have a solution. Like, I mean, that's just the way it is. If enough people want to play the original Halo 2 multiplayer, they'll bring it back. They'll find a way to do it. But for the most part, people who are playing it have moved on. And I think that's really it. That's why I know you felt really bad when they shut down those servers for Halo 2, but the majority of people didn't care.
Yeah, and I think you can still link consoles together. I don't think this works for 360 ones. Someone correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the original Xbox ones for sure you could do. I don't have one of those consoles, though, is the thing. And none of my DLC is on one of those consoles, and I can't transfer it over now that Live is shut down. But
just for me, though, gaming has been such an important part of my life for pretty much as far back as I can remember.
Right.
For me, like, it's important that these games are preserved. That's the thing. If I know that we're going to an entirely digital future, an entirely download, no physical medium, but that I know that every game is indeed possible to be legally obtained, I don't have a big problem.
Or even not legally obtained, you know?
Yes, but I mean, as it stands now, this is the first time in history that a game can die.
Yeah, like you can actually see when that cutoff date is going to be, whereas before, you know, there was I see what you're saying. Essentially, the game dies as soon as you buy it. Like, it's clocked out.
No, not even that, but like, if you have something that's download only and they decide to pull the plug on a server, it's done. That
right.
game doesn't exist anymore.
Right. I just...
Okay, this is... Let's see, how do I say this nicely? I'm going to call it a capital B with a dollar sign. And what Microsoft is saying is they said that the Xbox One is approximately 10 times more powerful than the Xbox 360. But they're saying that with the infinite power, is 40 times more powerful. That's not a real thing.
Wait, what? I didn't follow you at all. I'm sorry.
Microsoft came out and they said that when they were asked how much more powerful that the Xbox One was than the 360, they said that it was 10 times more powerful. But when adding in the power of the cloud, it was 40 times more powerful.
Oh, right. That I know Jonathan Blow really took issue with the 300,000 dedicated servers number, saying that it was most likely inflated because of virtual servers, and I can see that being totally plausible. That's the kind of BS nonsense you would expect them to spin to make it sound really impressive. But
it's like, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Like people don't understand or care about the difference between a virtualized server and actual physical server, because most physical servers are that you think are physical are actually virtualized anyway. So, what does that number even mean?
Like, even, you know, theoretically, though, Microsoft is big enough. It could be physical servers, but it would make no sense on profitability whatsoever.
Right, right. It's very unlikely. Not that I want to give Jonathan Blow a lot of credit for talking out of his... But...
Well, yeah, but that's just common sense. But, okay. I just... SimCity is a good example of this.
It's not even cloud computing. That's just being online because they have to talk to do multiplayer even when you're not doing multiplayer. Like, if you had to, like, render a shader or vectors or whatever on another computer that wasn't the thing you were playing it on, that's just scary to me.
Basically, look, I think that the cloud stuff is a lot of B dollar sign. Because no one's going to have high things being computed with inherent latency. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And it would take a lot for that latency to be decreased to a point, and not even the latency, but just like the uptime. 99.99% isn't good enough. Like when you are running from your device, you have 100% uptime, you know?
And okay, say I buy an Xbox One here in Japan. It's just electrons cannot move faster than the speed of light.
Right, right. There's physics involved, bitches.
Physics involved. So even if it was instant, which is impossible, but just say it was instant that the cloud can do this computation and send it back, just the amount of time it takes to get from Japan to Microsoft servers and back is not zero. But right. We're looking for zero.
Right.
And, okay, so someone will come on and go, well, Microsoft will start dedicated servers in Japan. Well, maybe. Yeah, maybe they will.
Yeah, with which gamers that will buy the console in Japan?
But what I'm thinking is for cloud definitely be incorporated into games for figuring out multiplayer AI, for things that don't require instant calculation. Sure, I can see that. But at the same time, I don't see how it's going to create, you know, better graphics or better, you know. And if it does, that scares me more than anything else. Like, say Microsoft is right on this, that the cloud is important for everything. And if it's really requiring that much data and that much transfer, when a game is no longer profitable for them, they're going to shut that down, and the game unplayable.
That's why it's not really the cloud. If it was really the cloud, it'd be the network of like name servers. That's really the cloud, because they're dumb terminals. They're not owned by any one person, and they all do the same thing. When Microsoft or any other company talks about the cloud, they're talking about their own farm of private servers. And those all are on altogether, or they're all off altogether. And there's redundancy and whatever. But, you know, as soon as they want to shut that pipe off, it's off.
You know,
It's not really a cloud. It's like their own little cluster. It's like a cloudlet, a rivulet in the actual cloud. Like the internet itself is the cloud. You know, exactly. It's not going anywhere. Microsoft can't control it.
Yeah, and totally.
If it were, that would be a totally different story. But that's not what it's like, and so they're throwing around this BS term like the cloud because people don't know or care what it means.
It just sounds nice. It's basically the infinite power cloud is the new blast processing.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, just from a technical standpoint, I just really want to drive home that, like, maybe there's, like, some redundancy and there's some, like, database clustering or, you know, there's, like, failovers for which server you're talking to so that there's, like, a relatively seamless experience, and that's cloud-ish. But that's just an iteration on the whole client-server thing. You know, they're still serving you. It's exactly. Definitely Microsoft doing it.
Also, if the games really did have to access the cloud for various things, texture maps, weather conditions, AI, things like that, how does it speak for multi-platform games?
Right. Yeah, that would definitely lock them into this platform, unless you know Microsoft's thinking they're gonna have like a PS4 game talking to their servers, which I guess is possible with this sort of model. Like, I don't know if anything about the game or network necessarily in the PS4 would prevent that. But, yeah, it just depends on the architecture, I guess. That's a very good point.
Outing that is one of their main features. Who's going to make use of that, you know? Already it's shown that the PlayStation 4 is going to be graphically superior, and Microsoft is hoping to make up for that with the infinite power. But, like...
Infinite...
That's what they say. They say infinite power
it's
of the cloud.
Infinite. Nothing's infinite.
Those are Microsoft words.
This just goes back to the whole messaging thing. Like, God. Okay, so if I'm going to talk about E3 again.
Sure, go ahead.
I really wanted to just kind of sort of talk about like expectations, but like they have such conniptions over... What's expected about the future of gaming in like 1 year versus just what's going to happen this fall? We can't really. I don't feel like we can focus on it, and it makes me think of E3 in general as this place there waiting to give us all their really good information. And I'm like, why? Especially when something like Nintendo Direct exists. Why?
Yep, exactly. We are now at a place where conferences like E3 are largely anachronistic. And I hate that fact, because going to TGS, that's like one of my favorite things in the whole world. But like, Nintendo ditched that years and years ago, and it's probably the smart move.
Well, like, if we're complaining about like video games from the past not being available anymore, it's a little different when you have like an information model from the past as well, because in the 80s, you didn't have the internet, not really. No one was using it publicly, and you certainly didn't like supplant magazines or TV shows or anything like that, like it does now. And so you had this model where you had this one big trade show for the year. You only allowed press in. The press would then discuss it on their newspapers or their magazines that you had to be printed and prepared like a month in advance and then sold, and people would buy it and go, oh, that's very interesting, and then throw it in the trash or leave it next to the toilet. We are constantly connected now all the time. We have blogs, we have podcasts like this one, we have TV shows, and information travels at the speed of light now instead of at a month delay or years long delays. And when that reality came to light and all these blogs were like trying to get into E3 to be press, they scaled back E3. They shut it down. They freaked out and they contracted until they open up their doors again. Now it's a big media event again, but it's like, why do I care to wait when they could just tell us now?
Well, exactly. And I don't know, like, Nintendo has made a lot of mistakes this generation, a lot of mistakes. But I think one of the things that they're doing well is the concept of the Nintendo Direct.
Yeah, I agree.
They can have a press conference that gets news and gets coverage any time they want. They often have like 2 days lead up time.
Yeah. But like the other big thing is like anyone can watch it. You don't have to be pressed to watch Nintendo Direct. Like, it's on the eShop. Before that, it was on the Wii and on the Nintendo channel. It's on YouTube now. Like, they don't care who sees it. And anyone who wants to can talk about it and try and put analysis on it. But what's the point? They can just go to the source. Which makes me wonder why, instead of having like distribution on Nintendo's network for like these E3 kiosks they're having with Best Buy, why they don't just distribute the stuff through their existing network? I think I understand from the context of like they want the general gamer who doesn't have a Nintendo system, a 3DS or a Wii U or a Wii, doesn't have any of those things, that they can be part of it. But like, I don't know why they also don't just put it on Nintendo's network.
Well, my guess is that a lot of the time these early builds are perhaps incredibly buggy, and like if you have the whole thing on your system, there's very much a chance that it could affect your console or that also when they put these out, they might be giving a lot. They might be putting up at E3 or at Best Buy a lot that would normally be in a traditional demo. You know what I mean? These right. might be nearly complete games.
That's also a very good point.
If you distribute this giant chunk of game, for free as a download, you might not want the final game, or things might change dramatically, and people will get very upset. Like, your E3 build had this, but
right.
It's the reason why at E3, despite the fact that they have these often running, sometimes on dev kits, but sometimes on actual hardware, that they don't give out demo discs at E3. And that's get back to messaging. You know what I mean? They have announced the new Call of Duty Ghosts for next gen and current gen, but they haven't announced anything about the Wii U. Now, just say it. If you're not going to have it, just rip the Band-Aid off, let us know. Then people will move on. But instead, they're like, maybe we'll. I don't know. I don't know who works here. I don't know.
Well, I just have to question, like, why they keep doing things this way when, like, you know, Nintendo's trying new and different ways of doing it. I think they're being successful at it because, like, Twitter blows up every time a new Nintendo Direct comes out. Like, it's like a group event, you know.
But until Nintendo starts regaining kind of a dominant position in the manufacturers, no other company is going to adapt the Nintendo model of reveals, you know.
I guess
it's a smart move, but one of the things with Nintendo right now is they don't have much to reveal. They can have these Nintendo Directs a while, but I'm tired of seeing more gameplay footage of Pikmin. I know it's coming out. Show me new stuff.
I guess I'm just sick of this, like, trying to centralize, like, information going out. You have a PR department, you know, and, like, anyone who talks out of line, like Adam Orth, gets canned.
Yeah.
Of course, he was being a jerk, even if it was, you know, potentially ripping between, I wouldn't say friends, but at least acquaintances. But, you know, it's a lot of public damage because then the PR department has to answer all these questions. And it's like, well, why didn't you have the answers ready in the first place that anyone in your company could look at, instead of, like, you know, don't say this, don't say that, just stick to these five meaningless talking points, and then, you know, when we have our official announcement, we'll let people know. And then it doesn't tell us what we want to know anyway. It's like a politician announcing they're going to announce that they're going to run for president. It's like, isn't that the announcement? No. I'm going to tell you if I'm going to or not. Well, we already can infer you're going to tell us, yes, you are running. Why are we waiting?
Well, I guess, I mean, for the most part, yeah, but remember Chris Christie had announced he was going to make an announcement, and his announcement was, I'm not.
Why didn't he just say he wasn't? Why?
Exactly. I don't know. People like attention? I don't know.
Like Dan Harmon's back on Community.
What?
Yeah, you didn't hear this?
When? What?
It's possibly because it wasn't officially announced, but there was rumblings on Twitter and other places. There was a panel, I think, at a convention, or like his podcast, he brought this up before. But apparently on Twitter, he quote-unquote officially announced that he is back on Community in Season 5, and you can thank Joel McHale for it.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Right? But...
Well, I mean, not... Dan Harmon is a bit of a... I mean, he's a bit of a drama queen. So it might cause as many problems as it solves, but the right... tighter.
Yeah.
And he's from Wisconsin.
Right? So these are all great things. No, yeah, I just bring that up.
You know that, right?
I think I heard that before.
Most famous skit that you've probably heard was the D&D skit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Dan Harmon.
Right.
Yeah. From Wisconsin. Sorry.
I just bring that up, right, because, like, I go back to Adam Orth, and I am blanking on the guy's name now. He did that Twitter book.
David Pogue,
yeah, it was probably him. I heard this about a year ago. I think it was a TED Talk or something. He discussed, especially with social media now, like, everyone's a brand ambassador. Like, everyone... This whole thing about having this, like, one PR department, this one PR person, this one PR event to get your message out is terrible, because you have all these ancillary contacts with the brands and no one is able to tell you anything, like my experience with Injustice.
Yeah.
Or anyone's experience with Adam Orth on Twitter, because he knew things he really couldn't talk about and was, you know, being very, trying to be vague, but it just came off in this awful, awful way. So David Pogue tells this story, assuming this is even him that told the story, about he went to this, like, restaurant, this, like, place that's infamous for, or famous for its breakfast, and, like, just really couldn't wait to eat there, and it was terrible. It was cold, it was, like, stringy, or, you know, just not great. And he came away thinking, well, that was terrible. You know, on his way out, he might have mentioned to the waiter that he was like writing reviews for restaurants and stuff, and he was going to give them a really bad review now because of what had happened. And like the cook eventually comes out and says, you know, I'm really sorry. You know, this is just the end of the breakfast period. We stopped cooking at this time. And if I had known you would have been here, you know, I would have, you know, I would have made you something special and made sure it was like fresh and well done for you. And it was that contact that convinced him that, that this restaurant's brand was worthwhile. Like this guy who wasn't a PR head, like it wasn't his job to do what he did, but he actually cared about his work. And that was worth more to him than, you know, some suit spouting talking points. And I think that's true of most people who are trying to use social media and why things get so bad. Someone gets fired for talking out of turn.
But, you know, it kind of turns the mirror on us, doesn't it?
How so?
We have an official Twitter channel. Do we need to be a lot more careful about what we say on it?
What do you mean?
I don't know. Famicom Dojo is a brand, right?
Sure, sure.
So, like, when I post pictures of, I don't know, just junk I find at recycle shops, am I cheapening our brand?
I don't think so. I mean, we don't have almost 800 Facebook followers because we were just reposting our website and podcast and YouTube content.
But, I mean, when we...
Well, okay. You know what does hurt us? When we teased for about a year now, when did the Double Fine Kickstarter come out last year?
Oh, it was the Double Fine's year and a half, maybe.
It was Marchish, wasn't it?
Was it?
Well, we've been teasing for the last year, like when we do our own Kickstarter project, and we just have just been teasing it.
That's true. We have.
Right, and we don't have an official announcement yet, but I feel like we should talk about it.
Should we just come out on this one?
Yeah, let's stop being hypocrites on this. Okay. Totally.
We Famicom Dojo are planning to launch a Kickstarter, and I mean we've alluded at it, and we definitely bring up other people's Kickstarters, but we've been planning this for what now? 6 months? 7 months?
Months? Yeah, at least.
And we've got things written up. We're almost ready to go. We've talked to people about goodies and rewards, but we just haven't pulled the trigger yet.
I think part of it is that we were trying to really get a focus, and that's why we don't announce things right away. I think there's something to be said for not saying what's on your mind all the time. But like in this case, I feel like we should get our listeners on our side instead of like being all coy. I'm like, well, you know, we might advance it eventually, but no, we want to know what you guys think, if this will be a good idea or not. We want to make a season 2 DVD.
And hopefully a Blu-ray.
I think that's the part of it that's kind of getting us right now, is like we want it to be a Blu-ray. And here's why.
Because we're doing everything in high def.
Yeah, we've been doing 720p, 1080p since 2009. And I think we feel like if we release a DVD, it's going to be a disservice to the people who have been watching us on YouTube in high definition for the last 3 years. 4 years. I can't do the math, apparently.
By ourselves, without any Kickstarter going on, to release just a DVD. But we really don't want to do that. We want to go all out on this one.
Right, right. So, you know, and then, you know, knowing that we don't want to, like, make a DVD version and a Blu-ray version, it's like, well, why don't we do one unified version? But that costs money that we don't have to print a dual format disc.
I mean, we're both fathers right now, and right. we've got other things on, and
this isn't our primary job. I should just go right there and say that it does not pay the bills.
People have been asking us people ask Famicom Dojo two questions. We ask for questions, and we're really hoping someone will be like, "When did Mario's sprite change?" or something like that. You know, because we can answer those. But
right.
The most getter, when are you doing new episodes? Mm. And season 2 coming out on DVD, because right. We've been selling season 1 for what, 5 years now?
4 years.
4 years, something like that.
Not quite 4 years yet, but it's getting there.
But, I mean, it's not that we're not wanting to do it, we're just trying to find the best way to go about it. And, you know, to tell you the truth, when it comes to a Kickstarter, we've been going back and forth on what would be the best Kickstarter, what people would appreciate the most, but I think really we should just open it up. What do you want to see? What goodies would you want? What is a good price?
Yeah.
I mean, we can't take everyone's suggestions, you know, fully, but just getting some information on that, I think, you know, Microsoft seemed perplexed and surprised, shocked when we got the negative backlash they received from the Xbox One. They realized that I think part of the reason gamers were so mad was because they felt completely out of the process. Like, what gamers actually want, companies don't really care about.
Right, and we'll give you money for that. I'm reminded. I mean, I want to keep talking about our DVD here, but I'm reminded of that Penny Arcade report article about how used games are making studios shut down. That makes me so angry.
Studios are making studios shut down.
Right. I mean, just what you said made me think about that. It's like, if they would listen to what gamers wanted, they would make the games that they wanted in the first place. Like, Kickstarter for games, I feel like, has been a really great thing because, you know, they know ahead of time if people are interested in the idea or not, and they can set their goal and be like, all right, if you want unspecified Double Fine adventure game, just an adventure game, just the idea of someone making an adventure game, do you even want that? And people overwhelmingly said yes to Double Fine. They have a second Kickstarter now for Massive Chalice, which I think has been funded already. Let me double check that.
It's either there or very close.
And it's not going to be, you know, a huge like record breaking thing like the original one was, but it's going to meet its goal. And
so cool. It's, it really sounds like Fire Emblem mixed with like Shining Force
and Game of Thrones.
You know, for generations thing. Oh man, it looks great.
Yeah, okay. They're still about $50,000 short, but they got 24 days to go.
Time this podcast comes out, it'll definitely be funded. Yeah. But the thing is, like, that's exactly it. Like, we've been thinking for a long time, why does this company do this again? And like, the whole crowdfunding thing is a way to tell them, yeah, you can do that without them putting in too much of a risk.
Right.
I think that's what scares us the most about our Kickstarter.
Yeah, maybe a big company can survive a Kickstarter failing, but I feel like if we don't give you guys the right thing and we go out there and it fails, we can't do it again.
Basically, and I mean we're trying to be realists, but at the same time we also have feelings. Kickstarter doesn't get funded, and it's at like $25. And 22 of those are from my mom. You know what I mean? I mean, it's one of the things about Kickstarter is it's really putting yourself out there. It's like, right now we believe that Famicom Dojo is something that people find important and something that it will take off. That there are people out there who care about retro gaming and preservation, and maybe kind of are on the same page with us. But I'm really worried if they do a Kickstarter fight that it's like seven guys.
Well, all right. So I guess we can tell them what we are planning on doing, at least. We had like ideas for content and stretch goals and you know, even rewards. So content, everything you've seen so far that was labeled season two, the not yet filmed or released Super Famicom episode, and possibly a fifth one. That's part of our problem too, right? Like, we had to whittle down the actual episodes we were going to release because we had this huge plan for like the CD systems and all this stuff, and it's like, let's just wait for the future on this. Let's do that later.
All the JoJo on the Go videos, all of the what are we, the question and answer things, the Denshi mail.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's one of the mistakes we made on the season one disc was like we had some Denshi mail material done already, but like, oh, we'll do season two really soon, and it'll be on that disc, so it won't matter.
You know, lots of Easter eggs, all kinds of stuff. The commentary, and we'll probably do commentary on the short videos as well, not just the episodes.
But like, you know, not just that. Like, we don't want to just like have people give us money for content that we already made. If we can hit these stretch goals, then we can do stuff like add more content that we haven't even done yet. Like, and we know people want the third part of the Virtual Boy special.
That as these go on, it gets harder to acquire the hardware.
Right.
And, you know, for doing things with obscure systems, which we get a lot of requests for, but it takes a lot of our resources to get those things that I mean, if we're going for full disclosure right now, Famicom Dojo is not, you might think of us as a bit of a big company, but Famicom Dojo doesn't make nearly as much money as it costs to make.
Oh, not even close. And that's why, like, you know, I think we could totally do a DVD without asking anyone for any help, but if we want to make this Blu-ray thing, that's like one of our big goals. Like, tell us if that's even something you want, because if it isn't, then we can just probably bypass this whole process right now. But like, if you want to see more stuff that we haven't finished yet, like the Virtual Boy episode, about like doing some team up stuff, like we can get this done and finished for the disc for you guys. If like the interest is out there and we can hit those stretch goals. But even the Kickstarter itself, like what would we even give you besides this disc? We had to think about that a lot too. We were thinking about digital versions of season one that don't exist yet. Like everyone can get that digital versions of season two before the disc is even printed. We want to give those out, and material that's not going to be on either disc, right?
And tons of unreleased material. All the stuff we did at TGS. Each time we went to TGS, we recorded, I don't know, 10, 15 hours of video, and we've put up like, 10, 15 minutes of that.
Right, right. Like there's lots of stuff from both of those that we could still put up yet. On the first disc, like a convention special ended up being an exclusive we haven't released anywhere else yet. That's just on that season one disc, but does anyone even know about it? I'm not sure. But you know, so we want the high def. We want to give you more content than is presently out. And I think as a reward for that, we won't even release some of those videos on our YouTube channel until they've been on the disc and you guys have had a chance to watch it first. I think that's only fair.
I don't know. The thing is, if the Kickstarter doesn't go, and that's the reason we haven't launched yet, because we know that once we put it up there, we've basically got just one shot at this.
Right.
If it doesn't go, it's going to be a bit of a blow to us, you know? But at the same time, I can't really see that we're going to stop.
Exactly. Exactly. Things have changed a little bit since our first DVD came out. It was our only revenue stream for a while, but it's still we want to be able to use that money and make more better Dojo, which is why we would even consider a Kickstarter, because we're not even going to cover the entire cost, I don't think, with what we're going to ask for. We're just going to cover most of it.
And I'm willing to pitch in,
yeah,
you know, out of my own money just to see it happen, because this is one of the best things I do. I really enjoy doing this, and it's because the people who are listening right now, you guys are the ones who are coming on and leaving comments and really making it worth doing. If it fails, it's definitely going to be an ego hit, but it'll still happen. It's just going to happen a lot more slowly.
Yeah, that I think we want to speak, like, no one's happy with how slowly things are happening right now, including us, and it's just, you know, a matter of time, a matter of money, and definitely not a matter of passion on our parts, because we want to do so much. Should we tell them about what we're planning for this year?
Don't give too many spoilers that are going to ruin their enjoyment of the video. But in general,
sure. I mean, next month, July 15th, is the 30th anniversary of the Famicom, and we didn't mean to spend so long on our 16-bit stuff as we have, but we've like been interjecting with like the 3D special, for instance, which, you know, went back in time, and that's stuff people really really like, you know, and there's so much more to talk about with the Famicom, the 8-bit era in general. So we want to focus on a few peripherals and a few games. That where it came out for the Famicom and the NES that we just didn't focus on before.
Yeah.
Like uh, I, I, one tease I can give you, because I teased it way back in January when I went to MAGFest, was the data recorder. Like, that wasn't just a neat thing you could use with, like, a Famicom Basic. There were games that you could save data onto with that. We want to do a whole episode about that for this year for the Famicom.
All of those games. Between Sean in America and myself in Japan, we have this hardware. All we need is the time to put this together. And I guess I got to ship some of them to you.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, we've been spending months, tracking down these games, getting stuff ready to put together to make into a video, because there's so much prep time we have to do now to make one of our episodes.
We could do a video on the data recorder, and it would be out next week.
Right.
The stuff we have right now, but we want to make the definitive video on the data recorder.
Absolutely.
And we've also got a power pad, family trainer here, and we are trying to acquire maybe not every game, but the majority of them.
We have 7 out of 10, I think. No, six. And the US copies as well. And those who know anything about that know that there is one particularly rare version that isn't any better than the other versions, but costs tens of thousands of dollars, which we'll get to in the video. But, you know, there's... We're not trying to raise money for that, I promise you. But, you know, those are the kinds of things that we want to do. And in keeping with that, we want to make sure that you're able to find this all in one place, so that especially when I put up non-video game-related videos on the That's Orange channel, that I'm not always asked, when's the next Famicom Dojo coming out? Where's the next video? We're just going to give you a YouTube channel for Famicom Dojo now. I think we can justify it at this point.
So I think so. And what else do we have in the pipeline? The Konami joypad thing. I've picked up a Satellaview.
Yep.
And I've hinted on that on the Facebook page, but it's a complete Satellaview, and we're going to do a video on that. I mean, there's going to be some really, really cool stuff coming up, but we just need the time and sometimes the money to do it.
So I think for this year, if anyone wants to know what we're doing for the Famicom Dojo, just think of these things. YouTube channel. We're going to have more games videos about the Famicom and games and peripherals for this year. And we want to focus on getting the season 2 disc out and getting the rest of the content for that done. And that's ambitious, I think. But if we get your support and help, I think we can do it this year.
And if you can't, if you don't have any money, that's fine. Just by commenting on the things, you really give us kind of the enthusiasm to keep going.
Money's nice too, though.
Sean's into the money.
Yeah, no, the feedback's good too. No, I really enjoy. We have regulars who comment on the podcasts every week. Every week that it goes up, I should say. And I love the back and forth, but I always like to hear new voices. I miss the lack. There's a lack of voicemails, and I miss the voicemails.
Well, I feel like we got a lot off our collective chest. I feel good. Although it is a little scary to say exactly what's going on there. So,
well, I guess we'll find out how many people actually listen to the podcast, won't we?
And since we know Microsoft listens to this podcast, the ball's in your court now, guys.
Yeah. Do we know that?
No.
I mean, we know Nintendo does, for sure. I mean,
all Microsoft's watching is television, sports, and Call of Duty.
I'm sorry, I heard this great comment. Again, on that Revision 3 Games video. I do not recall who said this, but this is this guy's impression of the entire presentation. It's like, hey, dudes! Hey, nerds! No, not you, the guys behind the nerds who beat up the nerds! Yeah, you! We got this new game machine! And guess what? You can watch sports guns on it! Yeah! Or whatever. Just...
Awesome. I love me some sports guns. Okay, I think that's one of our longest podcasts yet, but
that's not too bad. It's actually, I think, shorter than last week.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Well, let's wrap it up there. There's a lot of stuff that people who are listening might comment on. Do you think think we're as pessimistic as we should be, maybe even more so. Is this going to be the death of the used game market as we know it, or is it going to be a rebirth into something much more like that's going to have a digital locker with all of your retro games stored forever? And also, if you have any comments about the Kickstarter we're thinking of doing, whether we should do it at all, what kind of rewards you as the viewer would like to see, please leave us those comments as well.
Awesome. And you can leave those comments right on our FamicomDojo.tv website, which is where the podcast comments usually go. You can also talk to us on Facebook, which is a pretty hopping place. So that's Facebook.com, Famicom Dojo. There's also Twitter, Famicom Dojo. You can also call us, 608-492-1923. I repeat it just in case people don't like to run it back. 608-492-1923. I'll leave out a message about 3 minutes long about the podcast, about our Kickstarter, about anything you want to talk about, really. Like, it's always available. It's always there. And we may play your comments on the show if they're particularly pressing. We want to share it with people. So don't say anything you wouldn't say to your mom. Right? Or your grandma. No, mom's okay. Some moms are pretty cool and we'll bake you special brownies. What am I trying to say? Anyway. But if you just want to generally support the podcast, you can also go to our free iTunes storefront and leave us a comment there and rate us, because that will get us higher in the rankings and more people will listen to our wonderful show and hopefully think that these terms are a good idea too.
All right. I think we're out.
Okay. Yeah. Until next week, the Famicom Dojo is on message. I hope.
Famicom Dojo.